Hi, everyone. Welcome to Oscar Wilde After Dark, a bonus series where we discuss the wilder side of Oscar nominees and winners. I'm Nick Rurkraut.
And I'm Sophia Simonello.
And today I am super excited. We will be covering a movie that has its 20th anniversary this year. I think a movie we've at least mentioned multiple times on the pod, plenty of times off the pod, but it is National Treasure. I grew up loving this movie, and I'm so excited to break it down with you.
I can't wait. I think we are trying to figure out what to do for this month's After Dark. We were thinking, okay, maybe we can do something horror adjacent for Halloween. But then, just as I was perusing through the list of movies that had anniversaries come up, I sent you, what about National Treasure or National Treasure Turns 20? And I think you thought I was kidding, but I was totally serious.
I don't remember the context that we've talked about it before, but I just am always gushing. And I guess maybe I forgot if you had or hadn't before, but this is just such a quintessential Nick movie. So I'm glad it's for you too.
Yeah, it is a very Nick movie. Like, that makes perfect sense that you would love it growing up. And I remember on our, I think it was on our Disney draft with Ryan, where you talked about the TV show, which I have not seen. I haven't tried that, but this movie was huge for me growing up. My sister and I were obsessed with it. We would quote it all the time. Like, even just stupid, obscure lines about different facts from history or just the way that Nicolas Cage would say some of his lines. This is ingrained in my memory. Even just watching it again for this episode, I was just reminded of how much I loved it. And, you know, I'm not going to love it as much now, 20 years later, as I did when I was in middle school, which I think is the perfect age to watch this movie. But I loved it. And it reminded me that my poor mother, we got this DVD for her for Mother's Day. So that we could watch it.
She's like, why?
She's like, what? It's so funny because this also terrorized her because we wanted to watch it all the time. But we got this
as her
Mother's Day gift. Sorry, Mom, if you're listening.
Well, I thought I always had the DVD and I went to grab it because now on Disney Plus, there are ads and everything is just getting more expensive. And I'm like, wait, I want to watch this without ads. And then I realized I didn't have the disc. I'm like, oh my God.
No. So
I'm going to look at Black Friday and see if they have any deals on it. It's got to be like $5 at this point.
It's probably like in that bin if you go to Best Buy.
Yeah. But two, looking back at that Disney anniversary draft we did with Ryan, you are the only one that chose National Treasure. And it was Riley in Sidekick.
Oh my God. Yes. Okay. Well, I can't wait to talk about Riley. Pick. He's a great character, and I loved him growing up. I thought he was, like, such a fun addition, and I love the part in the movie when he remembers daylight savings time, and they don't. It's so great, because they know everything, and he, you know, I do wish I knew more information. I never want backstories, but I would be curious to know, like, how he got roped into all of this, and, like, how he and Ben became such great friends and so obsessed with the treasure since he isn't a history person, really. He's just a science guy.
Do they meet in school? I feel like maybe that is where, but I can't even remember.
His resume is so intense.
Right.
Ben's. With, like, the naval diving and MIT.
He's crazy. And I read the screenplay for this because I was like, why not? The only two screenplays I've ever read are like Finding Nemo and National Treasure.
Stop it.
I don't even know if I finished that one, but in the script, Riley works at Intel. And so he kind of like takes a leave to work on this little adventure. But that's not the connection either. So yeah, I'm either forgetting or just glossed over that. Info is not really important, but whatever the reason, I do love their friendship.
Me too. Well, so we're clearly getting ahead of ourselves. Let's get into some facts about it and our Oscar connections, of course, since this is an After Dark episode and National Treasure, of course, was not nominated for any Oscars, but we have some connections. Description here, Modern treasure hunters, led by archaeologist Ben Gates, search for a chest of riches rumored to have been stashed away by George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and Benjamin Franklin during the Revolutionary War. The chest's whereabouts may lie in secret clues embedded in the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, and Gates is in a race to find the gold before his enemies do. This was directed by John Turteltaub and stars Nicolas Cage, Diane Kruger, Justin Bartha, Sean Bean, John Voight, Harvey Keitel, and more. This was released on November 19th, 2004, so turning 20 this month. It made $347.5 million worldwide on a $100 million budget. Some awards here. This was nominated at the Teen Choice Awards for Movie Action Adventure. Definitely would have gotten our votes. It was also nominated at the VES Awards for Models and Miniatures in a Motion Picture for The Treasure Room. We would have been also so excited about that, like if we were covering everything back then. And it also was nominated for the Taurus World Stunt Awards for Best Overall Stunt by a Stunt Woman. And the description is, a woman hangs from the open door of a catering truck as it races through the streets. She successfully jumps from hanging on the swinging door to a van trying to rescue her. This is funny because when this scene happens during the movie, it looks really good, but it's also so scary. I'm like, it's just funny imagining someone working at the National Archives doing this.
Yeah, Diane did a lot of her own stunts. It was pretty clear in the movie that this was like a cut to and then being on set with a green screen in the background. But I thought it was very cool. I think this whole scene of the car chase is really fun. Again, nothing that would ever happen in Washington, D.C., but parts in the script and on screen of like cutting to all of the monuments that you're seeing as they're chasing each other is just something so far-fetched that it's really fun to see happen.
It does utilize DC geography really well. Like you do see the Lincoln Memorial and the Capitol and the National Archives. Like they do take you to most of the important touristy places.
And a lot of it was filmed on location. There were only a few that weren't. I think even in Independence Hall, this was like the first movie to actually use its tower to film with, but they also used Knott's Berry Farm, the exact replica they have there. And then the Arctic was filmed in Utah, but like everything else was on location, which I think also adds to the realism of this movie and why I think it stuck with me for so long. So the Oscar connections now, Nicolas Cage won Best Actor for Leaving Las Vegas. He was nominated for one other Oscar. John Voight won Best Actor for Coming Home, and he was nominated for three others. Sir Christopher Plummer won Supporting Actor for Beginners and was also nominated for two others. Caleb Deschanel, the cinematographer, was nominated six times in cinematography.
It's always crazy. We've talked about so many multi-nominated DPs on our After Dark series. You just think, like, how did they end up here? You know, how did Robert Elswit end up making Gigli? But Caleb Deschanel, father of Emily and Zoe Deschanel.
Stop. Are you serious?
Yes.
Oh my God.
I'm totally serious.
These connections, I never know of, like, the Nepo connections. Well, his nominations are funny. I couldn't remember if it was this or someone else who has nearly three times the nominations we'll get to. But he DP'd movies like The Right Stuff and The Natural, but then also The Passion of the Christ. And it's like these people's ranges. It's very fun to see and to see like what they also get nominated for. It's like, I didn't think that would ever make it, but it did. So then we have Jerry Bruckheimer as producer. He was nominated for Picture for Top Gun Maverick. William Goldenberg, the film editor, won film editing for Argo and had four other nominations. Judianna Makovsky, the costume designer, was nominated for three Oscars. Jeffrey J. Habush, an additional sound mixer, was nominated four times in sound mixing. Doc Kane, the ADR mixer, was nominated twice for sound and twice for sound mixing. William B. Kaplan, a sound mixer, was nominated 6 times for sound and once for sound mixing. Todd Maitland, another sound mixer, had 5 total nominations, 3 in sound and 2 in sound mixing. F. Hudson Miller, a sound effects editor, was nominated for sound effects editing for Star Trek VI. Kevin O'Connell, a supervising sound mixer, had 1 win in sound mixing for Hacksaw Ridge and 17 other nominations for sound, and then 4 additional in sound mixing.
Wait, he was nominated for Oppenheimer.
Yes.
Oh my gosh. I remember the name from our contender series, but took me a second. I was like, wait, he sounds so familiar. And then it took me a second, but yeah. Wow.
And then, yeah, names repeating, just like, oh my God, we've talked about them so many times before. Greg P. Russell, a supervising sound mixer, was nominated for 9 Oscars in sound mixing and 8 in sound. And last but not least, Nathan McGinnis, the senior visual effects supervisor, was nominated for visual effects for Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World. So I think just the list of like all of the technical people, especially in sound, makes sense in a movie like this where that is so important. I think if you don't get it right, it takes you out or it sounds kind of cheesy, especially as you move between all these different kinds of locations. Like you think of the cavernous end sequence and that elevator from like 200 years ago. And then you have the National Archives or the Declaration Room. You know, it varies in size. And I think that, again, feels real in the film.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like that was, I think, one of the longest lists of Oscar connections we've read through. And I think you wouldn't necessarily expect it for a Disney movie like National Treasure, but I think it is really well put together. Yes, it's cheesy, but I think that's part of its charm. And again, I'm going to be, I think in reviewing the movie today, really thinking back to how I felt about this movie when I was like 11 or 12, because I don't know, viewing it now and being hypercritical of it just isn't as fun. But honestly, like, it still worked for me. I still had a lot of fun with it when I was rewatching it. And, you know, just again, thinking back to some of those moments that I really loved and how, you know, also like growing up loving history and learning about American history, this was so supportive of that, I think, and in encouraging a love of learning in kids. Like, this is just a big scavenger hunt and action adventure movie, but, and it's not all accurate, obviously, but I don't know. It, even still today, like, or when I was in high school or college taking history classes, a lot of the things I would connect to, like the Liberty Bell or anything like that, I think of National Treasure still.
Yeah, there were so many things I loved, I guess, starting with the idea in general, going on this treasure hunt. I loved things like that growing up. And then I think deciphering all the clues along the way, that was something else that I really loved as a kid and a teen. And then getting into parts or aspects of the movie, this is a score that I just always loved and studied to. And this time rewatching it, I think that opening sequence into them driving in the Arctic with the title shot of National Treasure and the swell of the Trevor Rabin score just makes me so happy and excited. And that's just like a 10 out of 10 moment for me. So I think the score had a really big part in that too. And maybe something that got me more into listening to scores and movies growing up. I would have been in 8th grade at this point, so it was still pretty young and not really into the Oscars. So yeah, I think that's a big aspect that brings me back to this movie time and time again.
The score is great. I agree. It reminds me a little bit of the Pirates score and how I liked that one growing up, too. Just that really adventurous, fun score. And that scene in the Arctic is so fun, too, because you also get to meet Ian and his henchmen who are so annoying. I get so angry when I watch this movie, even still, because they just cut corners and use brute force instead of their brains to get anywhere. And there's a moment in the movie when Ben says that Ian is smart. And I just always thinking, no, he's not. He's actually not smart. He just wants to shoot at everything and cheat. And yeah. he's a very comical, like thinly drawn villain. Mm-hmm. But I think he works in the role, Sean Bean, because I really do hate him. And I think it actually affected how I felt about him in Lord of the Rings and Game of Thrones, where he's a good character. But in the back of my mind, I thought, you can't trust him, because my first entry into his filmography was, unfortunately, National Treasure. Right?
I feel like I never liked him, because maybe at that point, or I was starting to like differentiate actors from characters, but mm-hmm. he was just always villainous. And I also read a fun fact somewhere that this is one of the only movies that he doesn't die in. If that's right.
Oh my God.
It's like the next character I think of in a positive way is his character from Game of Thrones. And mm-hmm. I mean, that one he dies, but at least off the top of my head, that's the only good one I can think of. But this is definitely the first. Another thing about him that I realized recently with this watch was that, you know, this whole expedition, or I guess when you're hearing the history of this treasure read by Christopher Plummer in the very beginning, it's that they're always trying to keep the treasure away from the British and they keep hiding it. And who is the British character in this movie? It's Ian. So we're always trying to keep it away from him too. The funny part of all of this to me, and it's one that you see in the Arctic sequence too and throughout the movie, but they find the pipe, the Charlotte piece, and they find the clue and they're reading it. And it's just like time stops and everyone is waiting for Nicolas Cage, Ben Gates, to figure it out. No one else ever helps him except for Diane Kruger's character later on.
Yeah.
And then Riley with the daylight savings time, which apparently is also pretty unfactual just because of it would depend on the time of year, and that doesn't necessarily solve the issue.
I know. I always wonder that. That is like my one nitpick with him. Like, well, it could also be 4 o'clock. It might not be 2.
Yeah. So it's just like Ben is trying to figure out the clue and what each word means. And then he's like, it was resolved. It was resolved. And it's like the light bulb goes off and everyone's like, what do you mean? Tell us. Tell us what the answer is. Because none of us know. Ian's not helping. Yeah.
The way I still have this memorized, because we watched it so much. Calligrapher, not writer. But yeah, Cage is so hammy in this role. Like, I don't think he's totally trying to be that way, based on some of the things that he said about the character and taking on the role and how he interpreted it and everything. But some of his pauses and just the way that he says certain lines are so funny to me. It's mm-hmm. like a mix between a cowboy and a game show host. He is just always performing so serious. Like, he takes everything so seriously, but so many of his lines are so funny. So I love him in this. I really can't imagine anyone else, but you do believe him to really be addicted to this conspiracy theory. Mm-hmm. And you start believing it too, along with him, because it's this whole family secret and they're obsessed with finding it. And so much so that when he goes to DC, when he decides he needs to seal the Declaration of Independence to keep it away from Ian, that he's going to use a fake name, Paul Brown.
Yeah, I think when they reel in Dr. Chase in the hunt and they eventually convince her to do it not only with them but for them, I think that's mm-hmm. also another point that it's like, okay, I am fully in this experience. I'm glad that all of the actors are too, or else that would take me out. And I think seeing her shock in that moment with the declaration and how Riley is in, and even the dad, who this relationship, I think, is one of my favorite between Ben and Patrick, because Patrick is a total naysayer. Like, he wasted 20 years of his life chasing this treasure and never found anything. And it's just chilling of him saying, like, I found Charlotte. and you just see this shock on Patrick's face. And it's like, okay, he keep going because he's ready to do this again with you. And I think that father-son relationship along with these friends adds to everything. And then, you know, the FBI are involved later on, but all of the conniving and expedition, it all kind of comes together, I think, in a really fun way.
Yeah, I think so too. And I love when characters get roped into things like that. Like, I think I said that last about Faye Dunaway in 3 Days with the Condor, where you have a woman who just somehow gets wrapped up in everything. She's at the wrong place at the wrong time or has similar interests. And that's very much the case with Abigail. And I love when she gets on board. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I was growing up too, I thought she was just a great character because I loved seeing, I think, someone like her who was so smart and so into history. And just also, she was just like, I don't know, she was very cool. Always a character that I really liked. And, you know, of course, she's also beautiful, obviously, but it's not like she's just along for the ride or just there as a love interest. Like, she actually is contributing. And yeah, with Patrick, with John Voight's character, I love the scene when they have to, you know, after we have the great scene of them stealing the Declaration of Independence and planning everything out, Riley talking about how they won't be able to do it because of the temperature-controlled rooms and the bulletproof glass and everything. But then after they actually do pull it off, when they're at Patrick's house and he's telling them they need to apply heat, so they're looking at the map and they're writing down all the codes. And when he picks it up, his face when he sees that it's the Declaration of Independence is so funny. And that's the perfect reaction to have.
Yeah, and the other thing with Abigail is that she's a rule follower. And I was too growing up. I still am. But I think her going by the book, even as she's hearing about, you know, people want to steal the Declaration or, you know, thinking that that's impossible, I think you can rely on her as a viewer to be doing things right, even though it's like, how are they going to do this? Or how is Ian going to do this in a different way the same night? And then they'll converge at the Declaration. It's just your mind is trying to figure out what's going to happen next at every turn.
And see, you saying you're an Abigail, I think I'm totally more like a Ben. I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but I am, you know, a performer. I like bending the rules to help me achieve my goals sometimes. So I think that that's why we're a good pair.
Like when, oh my God, that's so funny. Ben saying, he's like, well, we have to steal it because they're going to steal it. So we have to steal it before them. And it's like him taking a picture of the security guard's badge with a really nice camera with a long zoom. And then just copying the photo onto that photo. It's like, that's so funny. But he's going along with it. Like he's going the distance. And I, at every stage of that, if I were like more of a Riley, I guess in this case, I would be so nervous.
Yeah, you gotta just mind over matter, put your head down. I also love how this is like a fake like Disney Bond sequence, like him in disguise in the security guard outfit and then in the suit in the bathroom, like changing into that.
Mm-hmm.
That's absolutely what it's going for. Getting her fingerprints from the coin and then from the glass. They're trying to make it feel like a spy movie too, which I just loved as a kid. And when he gets her password as Valley Forge.
Well, it's like the first instance of Wordle.
Yeah.
He's like going through all of the iterations and he's like, no, 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 it's Valley Forge. One of my favorite quotes comes from this too, because it's Riley. He's like, Valley Forge, I don't have that on my computer. And this is like 2004, like being a clear foreshadowing of what's to come with computers, I think is just a funny way of how they put that in there. But it's like, you have to think outside of the box. You have to like add in other letters that could have doubled.
Mm-hmm. And I think what's interesting too is that, and I think most people would probably say The Omen is a better movie, and I'm not comparing this, you know, I'm not going to say one is better or worse, but I know that on our last episode, when we talked about The Omen, one of my critiques, I think, was that I get much less engaged as they go on this journey and try to solve the mystery. Mm-hmm. But here, when they're going to these different locations, I actually become more engaged. Like, oh, now we're leaving DC and we're going to Philadelphia. And here's what we can find here. They have that great scene with the little kid counting the code mm-hmm. on the Silence Do Good letters. I love that moment. Everything with the Liberty Bell, bringing the Declaration of Independence into the signing room. That's such a funny moment, too. He's so dramatic there. He's like, takes that deep breath. The last time this was in this room, it was being signed.
And then going to New York,
of course, too.
Yeah. It's not only like, okay, where are we going? How many cities are we going to go to? Like, are we visiting every monument in American history? But I think that's different. I feel the same way than The Omen, because there it's like, we know what they have to do. And it didn't feel as necessary for them at that point in that journey when they're driving. But here, it's like, this really could go on forever. We don't know the end. We know what's at the end, but we don't know how long it's going to take to get there. And I think that's interesting reading through it too, because it's like halfway, we're still with the Declaration. We haven't mm-hmm. even gone anywhere else yet. So it's like, it's funny yeah. how it moves and how it's paced too, because by the time he's jumping in the water and we're in New York, I'm like, this could be like five more movies before we find the treasure.
I know. And I think today they would have made it just into a series. Like, I don't think it would have been a movie, but I think it works really well as a movie. It is a little bit long, but I think it does go pretty fast mm-hmm. considering all the locations they go to, and they have to have that big final set piece at the end, which I do think is really rewarding. Every time I'm in FiDi and have gone by there, I always think of National Treasure. But I think it's great how they trick Ian there and how it all connects back to the Meerschaum pipe that he finds at the mm-hmm. beginning. Riley crying because he sees the stairs again. Like, I think that's all just like, it's a great way to wrap up the movie too. It is hilarious. I was cracking up though, when for no reason, just out of the blue, I always laugh when this happens, when characters are close to death, when he just is like, come here. And he pulls in Abigail to kiss her.
So awful.
It's ridiculous.
I noticed that this time too. It's like, this may be his last chance after they've like crawled through this old creepy tunnel. And like the first thing he does, it's just like, obviously they've been kind of flirting the entire movie and he wants to make a move on her. It's also just completely unnecessary because it has nothing to do with the adventure part of it. And that's just like classic Disney adding this in for greater effect in the end. But I guess considering the very end, like, it is cutesy, I will say.
All right. So that was a preview of our After Dark episode celebrating the 20th anniversary of one of our favorite childhood movies, National Treasure. Next time on Oscar Wilde, we will be returning to a little mini series that we did a while back, which was discussing our best director winners who've won multiple Oscars. And there was one person we hadn't discussed who had many wins. So we will be talking about John Ford. So we've already covered How Green Was My Valley on our 1941 Oscar Rewind episode back in season 3. So we'll be covering his three other wins, The Informer, The Quiet Man, and The Grapes of Wrath. Some great watches ahead of us.
The most winning Oscar director of all time, which is kind of crazy, but I'm excited that we're finally talking about him. I guess more of his wins. I did like when we covered How Green Was My Valley, and I'm excited to discuss others.
Me too. So thank you all for listening. If you like our show, please feel free to rate, review, and follow. You can find us on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok at Oscar Wilde Pod. And if you'd like to hear the rest of this episode, including some of our questions that we always get to in the series and a special round of Smash Your Pass, please feel free to subscribe on patreon.com/Oscar Wilde. And you can also find our updated nomination predictions on our website at oscarwilde.squarespace.com.
Thanks, everyone. We'll see you next time.